disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with my help.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128-bit war, you play Nintendo on some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs for every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, July 29th, 2021. On this episode, we speak with somebody from the Puget Sound Tenants Union, which is a part of the Autonomous Tenant Union Network. We discuss what we can potentially expect with the possible end of the eviction moratorium happening at the end of the month, and how tenants can get organized to resist evictions now. We then switch to our discussion, where we talk about the doubling down of the GOP around fascist and conspiracy-laden politics and how this relates to a ramping up of an attack on voting rights. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. The fight against the Line 3 pipeline continues forward, with lockdowns and disruptions of construction sites being organized almost every day. A judge has also granted a temporary restraining order against local law enforcement who are blockading a road outside of a property water protectors are using as a base camp. New reporting by The Intercept has also documented how the pipeline company is essentially paying for local law enforcement to engage in a broader anti-insurgency campaign against Line 3 protesters. According to the report, so far Enbridge has reimbursed more than $1 million in expenses for things like crowd control training, overtime pay, and so-called personal protective equipment like riot suits and tear gas masks. With the promise of reimbursement on the table, police and Enbridge officials were communicating regularly in the year leading up to the final construction permit's approval. Meanwhile, the Interagency Northern Lights Task Force was pouring countless hours into building an elaborate infrastructure for quelling potential pipeline opposition. More than a dozen Northern Lights subcommittees met monthly or weekly. An agenda for a January 2020 task force meeting included a discussion on tracking people's phones and cars. The group also planned to discuss potentially backgrounding organizers for links to so-called terrorism and whether to launch a public information campaign on who they were and what they have done in the past. Multiple planning documents also described law enforcement's drone assets. Pro-pipeline group spent around $20,000 on Facebook ads in March and April alone, circulating testimony from motel, restaurant, and construction supply store owners about how friendly pipeline workers are and how much they've boosted business. Minnesotans for Line 3 describes itself as a grassroots organization of people who understand how important it is to have reliable energy to power the economy. But a disclosure form unearthed by DSmog lists Enbridge as a sponsor for Minnesotans for Line 3 TV ads. Pipeline opponents say the group is simply an AstroTurf organization, a grassroots organization hiding the fact that it is sponsored by corporate cash. For a continuous action update, see the Resist Line 3 Pipeline page on Instagram and the GNU Collective on Facebook. In Brooklyn, the bottom floor of an empty building was occupied by a mutual aid network called The Gym for the second time in 2 weeks, leading to a brutal eviction by the NYPD. In so-called Atlanta, residents of the Edgewood Apartments protested and rallied against an abusive manager who has been sexually exploiting tenants. Members of the Crescent Town Tenants Union in so-called Toronto successfully won a fight against a wave of harassment and evictions that landlords have been attempting to carry out in retaliation for tenant organizing. In Brampton, Ontario, a self-organized group of workers protest in front of the wage thief's home to demand that he pay his former truck driver thousands of dollars in unpaid wages. In Denver, Colorado, people held a counter-demonstration against a pro-police rally at the state capitol. And demonstrations continued in Minneapolis. However, a new private firm of security forces recently has been hired by the city, and it cleared an area that until recently has been held by protesters. Members of Florida Prison Solidarity had their charges dropped last week after a solidarity campaign for three people who had been slapped with trumped-up charges stemming from a noise demonstration outside of a prison earlier this year. In Elizabeth City, people gathered in protest to mark the three-month anniversary of the police murder of Andrew Brown. Banners were also dropped across the U.S. and beyond in solidarity with anarchists and anti-fascists who hit the streets of Los Angeles to face down violent Proud Boys and the LAPD in recent demonstrations. Construction for the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which would carry tar sands oil, has ramped up in so-called British Columbia. Workers have entered in the area where the tiny house warriors have been living and blockading construction, only to be met with continued resistance. The struggle is playing out on unceded territory, and you can follow Tiny House Warriors on Facebook for more updates. People gathered in cities across the U.S. and beyond to write letters in support of anti-fascist prisoners and to mark July 25th, an international day of solidarity with anti-fascists imprisoned by the state. In Atlanta, supporters of the St. Pauli Football Club held banners in solidarity, and in New York, people confronted a rally organized in part by the Proud Boys. Mutual aid projects also continue in many cities. In the Pacific Northwest, groups like the Williamette Action Collective and Symbiosis continue to gather food and water to take to tribal communities in need. And now for some upcoming events. On August 14th, there is a Rock Against Fascism Community Music Festival being organized in Portland. On August 18th, there is a Day of Action to defend the Atlanta Forest. On August 21st through September 9th, there is a call for abolitionist actions in support of prisoner struggles. On September 11th through September 12th, there are Running Down the Walls events in support of political prisoners being organized in various cities. On November 12th through the 14th, there is also a protest called against the White Nationalist American Renaissance Conference in Burns, Tennessee. And finally, if you value What's Going Down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource and you want to see us continue into the future, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. If you value this podcast and you want to support us, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Sign up to donate monthly. Give us a one-time donation on the site or through Bitcoin. You can also tell a friend about us, follow our RSS feed, listen to us on the radio, follow us on social media, and also enjoy other shows on the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. That's going to do it for us today. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
My name is Holly Blue. I am an activist in Seattle, and I work with Puget Sound Tenants Union and Rent Strike 2020.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So there's a lot of questions about this eviction moratorium ending, and it's kind of been up for debate whether it's ending now or if it's going to end, or, you know, there's been a lot of talk about it potentially ending over the past couple of months, and they've kind of extended it. Also, I think the other aspect of this is a lot of people are saying that, you know, evictions are already going on currently, so we shouldn't think that there are, like, no evictions happening right now. But just to get to the first part of it, tell us what you know about the eviction moratorium. Is it actually ending at the end of the month, and what do you see happening?
The CDC has had end dates for the moratorium and has been extending them this whole time. That means that there's definitely hope that it could be extended, and there are a lot of people who are out there advocating for that and fighting for that and trying to convince them. And honestly, while the CDC has been mixed on, like, you know, telling people to wear masks and just kind of being prepared, like, there are a lot of people who are vaccinated who are starting to get COVID-19. So I wouldn't be too surprised if they sort of, you know, turned around a little bit and started being a little bit more careful, which would hopefully include extending the moratorium further. I would say that I'm optimistic for the moratorium to be extended, but we have to be ready at any time because it could always just end. One thing that's related to this is a group of landlords and lobbyists got together and sent a letter publicly to, like, the Biden administration saying, hey, we can end the eviction moratorium now. You know, everybody's back on track. The economy is opening up. We're doing okay. And, you know, people are getting their jobs back again and everything. And so there's definitely pressure from sort of that side of the spectrum to open up the evictions again. So that is one reason to think that it may actually end, but essentially it's going to be a battle between them and the people saying, no, that's completely false. People do not have the ability to take care of this or to handle this right now. And which I can segue into the other question that you asked. So if the eviction moratorium ends, obviously, like you said, things are going to roll out differently in different states because different states have different laws. I mean, we still have our own statewide eviction moratorium in the state of Washington. Like, we had a statewide one before the CDC had one, and ours is not necessarily set to expire at the same time that the CDC's is. But there are plenty of states where that is not the case. And you also mentioned this, but yeah, people are getting evicted right now. I think there were like 40 the last time I checked in the last month in the county of King County, where Seattle is, because there are all these loopholes. I've worked personally with several different places that got evicted through the loopholes. Like the owner was like, yeah, here is my intent to sell notice. You need to get out in 2 months. And the accountability is not necessarily there, or it wasn't. It was, you know, we just got new statewide rent laws, but, you know, that's just Washington, and Washington is a better place to rent than a lot of places. However, here's what will happen. So there are 6.4 million households that are behind on rent in the U.S. right now. The total estimated rent debt from National Equity Atlas is $21.3 billion. If that all comes crashing down at the same time, everybody is going to fall over. It's going to be a disaster. It'll be a tsunami. What will happen is, first of all, courts could get overwhelmed with all the evictions if people file all at once. Courts, you know, are sort of built to handle a certain amount of cases in any given time. And they're also, a lot of courts still are at less capacity because of, you know, COVID safety and that sort of thing. And that's, of course, going to get worse in the coming months. Not to mention the huge amount of houselessness that would happen, since, of course, like, a lot of people don't have the resources or the knowledge or, you know, the money for lawyers to fight evictions in the first place. So not only would the courts get overwhelmed, but the resources that exist in various places for houseless people would also get overwhelmed. So all of the orgs that, like, help people who are getting evicted and the tenant unions and everybody would just have, like, everything blow up in their face. And finally, essentially, there would be an entire, you know, class of people who have been forced to not be able to have a job and not have enough money and not, of course, have savings because of the way that the economy is structured right now. And this whole group of people is going to be, you know, living paycheck to paycheck and barely surviving, and they're all going to have evictions on their record, and all of these people are going to have trouble finding a place to live. So it's really funny that a lot of the same people, especially in Seattle, that are upset that there are so many houseless people, that are upset that there are so many people, like, in tents and parks and that sort of thing, are also the same people that are landlords that are upset that there's an eviction moratorium. And it's like, guess what? If you start evicting people en masse, you're going to have a lot of houseless folks on your hand, and it's going to be your fault.
Do you feel like they really want to prevent that if they can? Like, do they want, like, a slow kind of roll? Because it seems like the landlords definitely are out for blood. They want their money back as soon as they can. It just seems like a recipe for disaster. Like, if they were to move to evict a bunch of people at the same time, it seems like the system would crash or they wouldn't be able to do it. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Yeah, well, for example, the Washington eviction moratorium has sort of requirements, because the idea of the moratorium is you can't evict somebody for specifically non-payment of rent. But one of the requirements in it is that landlords are required to make a reasonable payment plan with their tenants so that they can still get some money. And depending on how those payment plans are structured, depending on how much, you know, money there is that goes directly to landlords in different places, they might have different priorities. Sometimes it's not worth their time to evict people because they also have to pay for lawyers and they have to, you know, potentially get bad press. Of course, pretty much in all situations, the situation, it will favor the landlord in the sense that they have enough resources to handle it. Like, they can deal with evicting people. We don't have enough infrastructure to really, like, hold them accountable for those evictions. But in any case, there can be incentives that make it so that, you know, they could try to find somebody new, and they could probably do that. But a lot of the people will have evictions on their record and will have issues paying in the first place. Or they could, you know, see who they have that's currently living there and think, oh, what if I just make them be in debt to me for the rest of their life? Which isn't great either. And I would say that there's definitely battling incentives for landlords right now. And it seems like some of the landlords are being a little bit more reasonable and helping work out payment plans. But the fact is that if we just let, even if we still don't allow evictions and we just have all of the people who lost their jobs in the pandemic owe their landlords thousands and thousands of dollars, that's still a huge problem. That's still the savings of an entire generation gone. That's still like the ability of an entire generation to have like any kind of thing close to an American dream, which admittedly was already sort of dead, gone. Because they're all going to be in debt because of this one year where they just couldn't get a job because there weren't any jobs. So in the end, what we really need is to eliminate that debt. But otherwise, yeah, there's a lot of landlords. I know I kind of got off topic here, but there are a lot of landlords who might be better off working out a payment plan who are just going to be evicting. And that's worse for everybody involved.
Curious, your group up in the Pacific Northwest is part of the larger Autonomous Tenant Union Network. What are the conversations that you all are having? Because your network is very vast, includes very large organizations like the LA Tenants Union and beyond. What are you hearing people say about that, other tenant organizers?
We've had some town halls on how to organize with houseless folks lately, as well as, you know, I am a delegate for my local tenant union, which means I go to the delegate council meetings every month. A lot of the stuff we end up talking about is a bit more procedural because like ATUN is more about like coordinating the different tenant unions together and encouraging teamwork and that sort of thing than like doing a ton of, and of course, you know, we do our town halls. But, you know, of course we are talking about that sort of thing. And like, yeah, people are talking about what the local groups are that are advocating for local eviction moratoriums. And people are talking about how to prepare for when it ends, like recruiting people, making sure we recruit more tenant unions for the network so that we can all have solidarity. I know that locally we're doing like research on different landlords to prepare for this. And then basically just trying to figure out like what all the different laws are for different places and where it's going to get hit the hardest.
For those that are listening that are not maybe involved in a tenant organization, but obviously are in support, maybe they're themselves are behind on rent, what advice would you give to them?
Great question. If you are behind on rent, your best option is probably to find a local tenant union or a local tenants union. Even if you don't think there is one, there might be. And of course, I have to start with that. But then the question is, what if I can't, or what if there isn't a local tenant union? What if I don't have the knowledge or the resources to start my own? If you're interested in starting a local tenant union, ATUN has a lot of resources that can help you with that. And, you know, DSA is actually a group that ATUN is working with a bit to try to help folks start local tenant unions where there aren't any. And even if you feel completely out of your depth, it's a lot more doable than you might think, especially if you can get together with you and a couple friends, especially if they live in the same building, and, you know, go online, talk to ATUN, contact us. TANC, Tank, is a tenant union sort of resource collective in the Bay Area in California. And they make a lot of really, really useful resources, not just for starting tenant unions, but also for organizing at the lowest level, which is what I'm going to talk about next, which may be the most applicable thing to some folks. So if you can't find a local tenant union, or you don't feel like that's right for your situation, and if you can't start your own union there and or don't feel like that's right for your situation, you can just organize your building. And honestly, advising people on how to organize their building is something that I have spent a lot of time doing in the time that I've been working in housing advocacy and stuff. I should have a good link to say out loud right now, but I don't. But regardless, you can look up TANC and you can look up ATUN. And these places have a bunch of different resources for how to organize your building. And I'll also give you a basic overview right now. If you can get, so some important things about, you know, rent striking and organizing your building and everything. If you live, if you're behind on rent, chances are a lot of the other people in your building are too. And you can get everybody together and start exercising some power. So key things to note, start small, but be regular. If you want to get people together, just start talking to people. Start with, you know, solidarity over everything. Be like, is anybody, you know, behind on groceries this month? Like, can we help anybody out? Do you need us to like make a trip for you? And make sure that you talk to the folks in your building and develop a rapport. If you want to have weekly meetings, which is a great idea, it's important to like keep those up, even if people stop coming, because it really makes people feel like there's a regularity to this. And that's also a really good way to get people involved. Number two is that you don't need to get 100% of the people in your building in order to have power. I'm not saying that you should do a rent strike necessarily. It depends on the situation. But you only need, you know, 50%, maybe even less, of the people in your building to threaten to rent strike in order to get your landlord to really feel that pressure. Because that's still a lot of money to just, you know, have them not have access to all at once. Finally, about rent striking in general, once you have a rent strike happening, there's not much more you can do. So it's good to try to save that, you know, as a last resort. You can start with negotiating. It's important to get your group of people together that you have in your building and talk about what your goals are, what your demands are going to be, and if they are not met, what you will start threatening if they aren't met. You can do things like demand deliveries where you write up your demands officially and send them in an email, or drop, you know, take a piece of paper and put it at their house or something like that. And of course, where landlords live is generally something you can find online depending on where you live. And there are resources on how to do that also. Yes, so some examples of ways that you can put pressure on your landlord that aren't a rent strike are you can let other people know about the shady stuff that they're doing. If they're not fulfilling people's requests, or if they're not, you know, being cooperative in as the eviction moratorium comes to an end, you can spread the word about it. You can say, look how shady our landlord is. And that bad press can really put a lot of pressure on them to cave into some of the demands, because that can be a problem for them, you know, getting business. You can also, you can leave reviews online and that sort of thing. You can go find their other buildings, maybe if it's like a property management company. Sometimes it's difficult to exert pressure at the building level if your building is part of a huge complex or is owned by a company or it's managed by a company that manages a ton of different buildings, or if you live in a house. So what do you do then? You should be able to, either through just like having corresponded with them, or there are ways to look online to see like which places own which property and that sort of thing, depending on the city that you're in. You should be able to figure out who owns the property that you're on. And you can probably figure out who manages the property that you're on. And if you, let's say you're in a house, you can figure out what other houses are owned by this person. And you can go to their houses and you can knock, or you can leave a flyer, or you can leave like, you can send them a letter with like your information and say, hey, like, are you doing okay on rent? Like, we're not, and our landlord's being really bad about it. And could we like, you know, talk about solidarity and that sort of thing, get to know these folks. And if somebody is a property manager for six houses and you get three or four houses worth of people together, that's a lot of pressure. So to summarize, find a local tenant union. And if you can't, or that's not right for you, you can try to start one. But if you can't, or that's not right for you, you can organize your building, or you can organize all of the tenants that are managed by a given property management company. And that can sound really intimidating, but I've worked with a lot of different folks who've been able to make it happen. Even if you're doing, you know, organizing your own building, tenant unions that are nearby can be really helpful with that. And they can help you research your landlord. They can help you give you resources. And it's definitely doable.
Yeah, I guess one of the benefits with knowing this thing is happening soon is that it gives you a reason to go and talk to your neighbors or people in your building and kind of get ready for whatever may happen.
Mm-hmm. It's important to have solidarity in advance of the disasters striking. If you can build that up, that's awesome. Talk to your neighbors, get to know them, figure out who's in trouble, help them out in whatever they need. Develop the sense that you're all in this together. Because then when something happens, you're ready to stand up for each other.
Well, anything else that we can talk about in terms of the just this moratorium and if it's going to end? It looks like it's going to be different in different places, which will probably help soften the blow. I'm sure that's part of the design of this. But anything else that comes to mind that you want to touch on?
Yeah, sure. I have a few fun facts I can drop. When I'm talking about my own state, which does have its own eviction moratorium, but it has also been in danger of ending for a while, the normal number of evictions filed in a normal year is 17,000. And the number of people who are in danger of eviction or mortgage default if the moratorium ends is 60,000 to potentially 140,000. So that's just to show how bad things could get if evictions start happening at a huge scale. And I just want to conclude, I guess, by saying that, you know, in the words of Bernie Sanders, before the pandemic even began, well, this isn't words. Okay. Paraphrasing Bernie Sanders, before the pandemic even began, the housing situation in the U.S. should have been considered a state of emergency. It's that bad. And this has only made it much, much worse. So we need to figure out a way to make housing a human right at the levels that it needs to be at, because otherwise all of the people who are relying on the poverty class in the U.S. to do all of their work for them are going to have a bad time when suddenly those people can't even keep themselves afloat.
I don't know if you have this handy, but there was some like extreme statistic, the amount of debt that's actually, maybe you already said this, even like collectively owed to landlords.
Yeah. I found the thing yesterday when I was getting ready. So the estimated total rent debt in the U.S., and these data, and which is great, is that this data comes from July 5th. It comes from a week and a half ago. So it's very recent. The estimated total rent debt is $21.3 billion.
Wow.
The estimated number of households behind on rent is 6.4 million people.
Yeah, it's just really terrifying to think about. I mean, there's already so many people, like you said before, you know, before the pandemic, there was already a housing crisis, both in terms of people not making enough but still working and not being able to afford, you know, housing or getting kicked out of their housing. Or, I mean, there's a whole push of people that have been like just pushed, you know, out of their homes and basically into their cars. I know in like places like Silicon Valley, that's a huge thing, or like in other big metropolitan cities on the West Coast. I know up in Pacific Northwest, that's a big thing too.
Lots of gentrification.
Yeah, everything. And just thinking about what would happen if this really did push all those people that are so much in debt, that would not only be in debt, but then be homeless, and then right when there's like another wave of the coronavirus happening as well, and people are still expected to go to work and work three jobs just to get by, to pay for their debt while they're sleeping in their car outside somewhere.
The world since Ronald, or the U.S. since Ronald Reagan, has been an experiment by the ruling class to see just how much they can squeeze out of the working class before they stop being able to like keep themselves afloat at all or just survive. And we're starting to come to the point where if they push any harder, people are not going to be able to survive. They're not going to be able to run their factories in the end and run their, you know, businesses and their restaurants, because there won't be a working class for them. So when we start to hit that point, usually it's either more concessions or a big conflict.
For those listening that are in the Pacific Northwest that want to get involved in tenant organizing, do you want to just talk about how they could go about finding the Puget Sound Tenant Union?
Yeah, absolutely. So Puget Sound Tenant Union, Puget Sound Tenants Union is covers a lot of just, you know, what's near Puget Sound. So we have Seattle people, we have Tacoma people down to Olympia, and as north as Bellingham. If you're in the state of Washington and you are looking to get in touch with the tenant union, I mean, honestly, get in touch with us and we'll help. Puget Sound Tenant Union does a lot of like low to the ground work. We help with specific tenants, but we're also kind of small and kind of new. There's something called Tenants Union of Washington, which I believe is tenantsunion.org. So they got the good one, is Tenants Union of Washington. And they're a great resource as well. I would definitely recommend, if you're not in our area, you can get in touch with them. Or they have a lot of really good resources about like how the laws work in different places in the state for tenants. And then Puget Sound Tenants Union, you can get in touch with us at soundtenants.org. Or email us, I think, contact@soundtenants.org. And we, you know, we can do our best to help. And if you're interested in getting involved, definitely get in touch with us at soundtenants.org. That would be really great, because we could really use help, especially as the moratorium threatens to end soon.
Dear policeman, it's me again, another black citizen. I wrote this letter a million times. Is the chief getting this? Is anybody seeing this? Does the mayor even read this shit? Scratch that, don't wanna seem like that angry black man. Listen, we've been peacefully protesting for a while now. We still getting shot down. Please tell your homies calm down. We tried to kneel at a gang to gain some respect, and they all turn around and kneel on our necks. What's next? You supposed to serve and protect, but I don't feel protected. One of your homies on Facebook used my picture for target practice. How the fuck I'm supposed to feel? Scratch that. There I go, sounding like another angry black man. Look, I'm trying to keep the peace with you, cause I got a cop for a neighbor, and man, he's pretty cool. Seems like a decent dude.
Does that even matter though?
Oh well. Maybe you two should do lunch. No lie, me and my black friends are pretty dope. If you got to know us, maybe we can talk about it over coffee and donuts. The world thinks you're a hero, but you gon' have to show us. Cause I done witnessed too much pain. Marched with my picket fence through the rain. How many more tears do we gotta cry? How many more times you gon' take our lives? Our lives. Yeah, mama told me God the only one I need to fear. But when I see your red and blue lights in my rear, I say a prayer cause my life could end here. Depending all on how the cop feels. You hate me, I know it, you hate me, I know it. You see my face and you can't wait to reload it. Man, I'm tired and broken, my words go unnoticed. I'm done being frozen. How about I kneel up on your neck until your bitch ass is choking? How about I burn your businesses down and take what you owe us? Bust the windows out of your cars and do it over and over and over and over. Cause y'all killing us over and over. You treat us like prey. This PTSD won't go away. You damn right I'm angry and black, bitch, you made me this way. Got these children scared to be black, cause how y'all do it today. Michigan State Capitol, they protesting with guns, and y'all ain't do nothing. And we out here protesting unarmed and still get bombed, and y'all still don't see the prop. It just happens so much, I learned to live with the drama, deal with the trauma. All praises to the high, in the end y'all gon' deal with the karma. I know y'all tired of riots, and I'm tired of writing. I hope y'all get this letter, cause I ain't finna write another one, Mr. Police. Rest in peace, George Floyd, and all the other black lives we lost to police brutality. It's Quillen Jabre, by the way.
Okay, once again, we're back for another week. Just to start off, you know, as these protests in Cuba continue, I find myself thinking of this episode of that some media produced a couple years ago that we've talked about before, but they had the author of Burning Country about Syria on, and he was saying how so much of the left is just obsessed with states, and a lot of the conversation that takes place on the left is just, you know, the policies of certain states and what certain states do, as opposed to looking at movements and actions of people and what people do, which is what I think anarchists and other fellow travelers talk about, and what we're obsessed with is what are actually people on the ground doing and how are they organizing, how are they responding. And the reason I bring this up is because as there's kind of like a string of roving protests. There's looting, clashes with the police that are going on, which is, I mean, happening all over the world, but now it's hitting Cuba in the face of not only the disastrous consequences of the U.S. embargo, but also, you know, the policies of the Cuban state itself and just, you know, the effects of global capitalism, which, of course, Cuba is not immune to at all. A huge part of their economy is based on tourism. That people are responding, and I think that's great. And I think it's sad, again, that the tankies are basically thrusting themselves in that conversation to be the wet blanket, to call anybody that basically cheers on the proletariat acting in self-activity is somehow a CIA stooge or something like that, or somehow a cheerleader of U.S. imperialism, as if you can't be against U.S. imperialism, against the U.S. state, also opposed to the Cuban state, and in favor of the Cuban proletariat fighting back, as if any of those things are somehow contradictory, that you can, the only position to be is in support of, you know, this decrepit, dying regime.
Well, and that lack of complexity has real costs, right? We saw this with Hong Kong. Like, what was going on in Hong Kong was really complex. There were anarchists involved, there were liberals involved, there were conservatives involved, there were nationalists involved. Like, there were a lot of different factions of people involved in the protests in Hong Kong, right? And it is entirely possible to, say, support the drive of the people in Hong Kong to not live under authoritarianism, while at the same time being critical of the sometimes utopian understandings of Americanism that motivated a lot of people there, right? That we can really think through nuance. We don't have to not think through nuance. And we have to think about the cost of what happens when we simplify everything, right? And there's a sort of very immediate cost, which is that we end up having to engage in intellectual contortion, right? That if you take a position like the PSL, which is this position that any regime that calls itself socialist is inherently good, and every single thing that the US does is inherently bad, and that you're going to support that position unquestioningly, perpetually, forever, well, you're going to have to really engage in some mental gymnastics to explain away stuff. How do you explain away Chinese concentration camps in Wuhan, right? You can't. How do you explain away, you know, North Korean political genocide? You can't. How do you explain away the fact that Cuba currently is typified by extreme, extreme wealth stratification right now? That people that are in government, people that are members of the Communist Party, live very comfortably, and your average Cuban standard of living has been declining pretty consistently since the beginning of this decade, or since the beginning of the century. And so when we aren't willing to take those nuances into account, what we end up with is we end up with this politics, which is simultaneously a politics of conspiracy theories and distortion, and propaganda, and also a politics that fails to be able to inform any understanding of what resistance looks like. That in this world that we're starting to see tankies try and construct, what's going on is that, according to them, the CIA has somehow magically convinced thousands of people to go out into the streets and, like, risk their safety for question mark reason. There's no way to explain that way. You can't explain away the Hong Kong uprising by talking about how it was a CIA coup attempt. You just can't. There's lots and lots of people in the streets taking lots and lots of risk, and they're doing that for reasons that they feel very strongly about. And so it's not as simple as just being able to say, oh, it's a CIA plot. But when we do that, we are immediately constructing a conspiracy theory, right? Because there's, of course, no evidence of that. So then we have to do what QAnon does. We have to go out there and just retroactively come up with things that somehow justify the position that we're holding, even if there's no verification those things are real. That happens a lot. Like, there's no evidence that there's a CIA coup in operation in Cuba right now. But so to explain away proletarian resistance to an authoritarian socialist regime, tankies have to go, oh, but the CIA must be involved, because obviously the proletariat would never rise up against the socialists. Why would that happen, even though there's, like, ample historical examples of things exactly like that happening? So then they have to construct the sort of idea of the CIA coup, right? Why do we think that there are concentration camps in China? Well, it couldn't possibly be because there's literal satellite imagery, or that journalists have gone there and snuck around the outside of the camps and taking pictures, or that people have come out of the camps and talked about their experiences, or that Chinese soldiers have defected and talked about their experience. It's not that. It's all CIA propaganda, right? Like, that is what ends up happening. We can't see the thing that's immediately in front of us. Now, we talked a lot over the last 4 years about how Trumpism was this act of gaslighting the American public, of telling us that the thing that was immediately right in front of us wasn't what was happening. And what is happening with authoritarians now? What is happening with tankies now? They're gaslighting every single one of us. They're trying to tell us that the people in Hong Kong that fly the black flags during the protests, they're not actually anarchists. They're just, you know, CIA operatives or people that are on the payroll. Like, it's ridiculous. So then we end up in this reductionistic world of conspiracy theories, which the state is this kind of fetishized object, right? And in which we are willing to excuse away really horrible stuff like genocide, like political repression, based on a combination of some reductionistic, silly argument about, quote, imperialists and propaganda that is meant to sort of absolve a regime of responsibility, right? So then when we start to accept that, not only do we look and sound ridiculous, because essentially at the point where one has accepted that, they have accepted conspiracy theories just as much as anybody that listens to Alex Jones has, right? Like, there is functionally no separation on the level of how much you're willing to accept conspiracy theories at the point in which you become a tankie in the United States. But most importantly, we can't inform our own practice based on what we see happening in these places if we can't recognize the complexity of that. Now, all of this is born out of a very simplistic understanding of revolt, which is held by these people. And traditional anarchists, a lot of them are guilty of this as well. But there's this idea that there are like this unitary body of people that at some point will have this grand revelation and end the capitalist world and inaugurate the new utopia. It's Christianity, right? I mean, that's what it is. It is millenarian Christianity, right? And within that, the people that revolt are all a singular body. But we know that that's not the case. And we know that people get motivated by lots of things. We know that revolts emerge when the distinction between those that consider themselves politicized and those that don't breaks down. So very obviously, it's not a question of political allegiance either, right? It is a question of complexity and the nuances and contingencies of history. We lose our ability to see any of that when we take positions like what's being taken by tankies in relation to something like Cuba or Hong Kong.
Well, moving on, we're going to talk about what happened at CPAC, this continued drift into open, anti-democratic, authoritarian, fascist politics. We're going to be talking about the Biden administration's response. There was a speech that Biden gave the other day where he basically called, you know, this new wave of Trumpism based around this big lie that the election was stolen, basically called them, you know, new Confederates and said this is the biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War. We're going to kind of unpack what this means and also just talk about how this is sort of a paper tiger that even though the heads of the Democratic Party are really calling this out, which the rhetoric seems more intense than usual, but at the same time, they really aren't doing anything to really combat this. And also, I think the bigger question is that as the Republicans push all of these anti-voting laws, does that actually mean anything? Are they actually going to win because of this? Is this a strategy that's actually going to get them into office? There's a lot of fear right now, I think, of Trump launching another coup, of, you know, the Republicans basically passing all of these authoritarian laws, getting themselves into power in nefarious ways, and just kind of running with that. I mean, are those fears justified? I mean, these are things that we talked about in earnest at the kind of the turn of the year. So I think it's important to kind of return back to some of these, you know, pretty terrifying thoughts about, you know,
this party really seizing power in an anti-democratic way, and really tease out, like, you know, are those fears justified? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is the reality? And also, I think the other big question is, you know, what does all this stuff about the filibuster mean, like, mm-hmm. that all the news is talking about? So, I guess to start, I mean, do you have any thoughts on CPAC? And I guess this, you know, CPAC is, I think, happens like a couple times a year. Feels yeah. like we just talked about this. But, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, what does it mean that this is basically like one big Trump rally? I mean, there's people like selling QAnon shirts. Like, they not only let in Stuart Rose from the Oath Keepers, but I think they mm-hmm. like gave him a pass, and there was mm-hmm. people from the Proud Boys doing security. I mean, this seems to be kind of like doubling down on this like Trumpian base, but at the same time, is this like a winning strategy?
So before diving into what all this means for, say, Republican strategy long term, I think it makes sense to talk about what actually happened at CPAC and why what happened at CPAC this time is relevant in ways that what's happened at CPAC in the past is not. And it has to do with a subtle shift in the way Trump was speaking that was noticed by a number of journalists that very astutely pointed this shift out, and kind of drew out the implications of it. And so what happened, you know, sure, plenty of ridiculous people spoke at CPAC. There's always lots of really funny costumes. There's absurd stuff like giant Trump statues. I think someone auctioned off a giant Trump blanket. Some paid like $7,000 for it. You know, like there's always these kind of absurdities of CPAC, right? And there's always the kind of controversies of CPAC where like people like Richard Spencer try and go and they say that they can't, and so on and so on. And there's like controversy around that. But that's usually it. I mean, generally you kind of get the idea of where the conservative movement is heading at CPAC. But we've already known for quite some time. I think probably CPAC 2015 is where it became pretty obvious that Trumpism has some legs. And so we know that CPAC is going to be a Trump rally, right? At this point, like that is what has happened. The kind of moderate wing of the Republican Party has more or less disassociated itself from the American Conservative Union, which is the organization that throws CPAC. And it's been given over to the MAGA crowd almost entirely. And so what happened during CPAC, very specifically during Trump's speech, was really interesting. So, you know, of course there was the standard, the election was stolen, blah, 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 you know, like, this was taken from you, you know, like that general kind of rhetoric you hear from him. But then three things were really different. And they point to a shift in Republican discourse, which is really disturbing. The first is that Trump stopped talking about 2024 during the speech. Or at least that wasn't heavily emphasized. He kept saying he's going to come back soon. Now, we all know that he's been sort of talking about this mythological August reinstatement. And that's not based on anything. In fact, Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, is the source of that, that claim that Trump is going to come back in August. He's the first person that started making that claim. And when he was asked why he thought that, he essentially said, that's the amount of time I think it's going to take for all of his, like, you know, conspiracy theories to be proven true and Trump to be put back in office. Like, the date's not based on anything. Like, August isn't grounded in anything. There's no, like, weird sovereign citizen kind of connection. There's nothing. It's like, literally the MyPillow guy said that this is going to happen and Trump has kind of run with it. But that's really relevant in the sense that he is no longer talking about winning an election. He is not talking about popular support. He's not talking about, you know, doing what's right for America. You know, like the things that normal politicians say, or even that he was saying disingenuously, but saying nonetheless while he was in office. Instead, now the rhetoric is about when he's going to return to power and how he is going to, you know, be the person who's going to support his supporters when he's in power and punish everybody else. Okay? That is a clear shift into a form of overt authoritarianism. dictatorial authoritarianism. That there's not this discussion any longer in Trump world about there being a single American electorate and all politicians work in everyone's best interest. And, you know, really this is a country we all have to share together and blah, like that. That's not talked about anymore. Instead, what's happened is that the idea of the real America, quote unquote, which we talk a lot about on this show, but this idea, which has sort of formed the foundation of white supremacy in America, that's formed the foundation for reactionary conservative politics, that's formed the foundation for the religious right, and that formed the foundation for the kind of, you know, creation of the citizen soldier in America, is this myth that's really grounded in the idea that the political divisions that exist are existential and absolute. And that the only way to, quote, save America is to destroy everyone that disagrees with you. Now, for a long time, the Republican Party was able to not actually talk about the implications of that. They've been saying it for years. The rhetoric is not particularly new. Pat Robertson's been saying stuff like this for 30 years. Jerry Falwell used to say stuff like this constantly. So it's not like the idea that you need to crush and destroy your enemies is new to conservative politics. It's actually probably as old as conservative politics. But what has changed is that, at least in the past, they paid lip service to the idea that really that was just rhetoric. They didn't really mean it. They were just trying to rile people up, blah, blah, blah. When Trump goes up on stage and says this and starts talking about coming back in August and starts talking about how he's going to, you know, destroy his opponents and things like that, when he frames it in existential terms, when he's saying, if we don't do this, then, you know, you're going to die and America's going to die and everything's going to fall apart because the cities are like smoking hellscapes, right? Whatever rhetoric he's using, what he's putting forward is this idea that the only way that his base can save themselves is by seizing power. Not in an electoral sense, but just seizing power. If we all notice, there's not an election in August. It's an off year, right? It's an odd number year. And so when he's talking about this, he is talking about his people seizing power. But then he does two other things during this speech, which come to set the stage for the expectations of that and to set the stage for the glorification of that. So the first element of this is Trump started talking about what happened on January 6th as the act of great patriots. And this is now like the fourth position that the Republican Party has taken on what happened on January 6th. So like the beginning, it was, this is terrible and awful and horrible and, you know, people need to be punished and blah, blah, blah. And then like a week later, it was, oh, well, you know, I mean, it wasn't really that bad. Like, I mean, they weren't trying to like overthrow the government or anything. This was just a protest that got out of hand. And then the week after that, it was, oh, it was just a tourist visit. They weren't doing anything bad. They opened the doors for them. It was just a tourist visit. All those three positions caused a lot of controversy on the right wing, because there are people on the right wing that want to own January 6th. They want that to be theirs, right? That they did this thing and they are proud of it. And everyone that's against them is like working for the deep state, or, you know, however they want to frame it. But that was generally a fringy position up until CPAC. And at CPAC, Trump reframed everything that happened, not on the level of being innocuous, which I think is what was happening before. They were trying to sort of make what happened on January 6th not seem like an existential threat. Trump went a step further and glorified it. And he said, this is what we are meant to do. This is how we are going to save ourselves. This is how we are going to save America, is by doing these things that great patriots do, like storm the Capitol building. And then as a way to talk about that, as a way to glorify it further, he goes forward and he calls into Maria Bartiromo's show the next day. She's a Fox News host. Calls into her show the next day and he's talking, you know, she's just asking him questions and stuff. And he gets onto the topic of Ashley Babbitt. So for those of you that do not know, Ashley Babbitt was the person that was killed by Capitol Police while she was trying to leap through a window to breach the House of Representatives chamber while there were still House reps in the room. Like if there's any situation in which being shot by police is like the logical outcome, like the thing that very likely is going to happen, it generally is when you're trying to assassinate politicians, right? Like that's one of those situations where really often, whether or not you like the police or the state, there's at least not a ton of controversy about someone taking that activity. You might not like that they're a functionary for the state that saved a person or whatever, but there's very little controversy about the decision itself. And it's not politicized generally when things like that happen. So take, for example, the assassination of Ronald Reagan, the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan. The shooter was shot and tackled and put in a psych ward. And nobody, I think, raised a lot of alarm about that, right? And that might be a mistaken position. I'm just saying, generally, there's not a lot of controversy about that specific shooting. Trump changed that narrative entirely. And what he said on Maria Bartiromo's show was essentially Ashley Babbitt was just walking through the Capitol and the chief of security for some Democrat, and he knows who it is, and he might say who it is, some chief of security for some Democrat executed her. So now we go from Ashley Babbitt being this right-wing conspiracy theorist who's trying to assassinate politicians to Ashley Babbitt being this innocent participant who was executed by the police without justification, right? And that, as he said, that's why she needs to be considered a martyr. And he used that word, martyr. So now you've got Donald Trump talking about returning to power in the absence of talking about elections, right? He's just saying he's going to come back in August, saying that the things that people did to try and keep him in power were the acts of great patriots, and then valorized one of these people as a martyr for the cause. He constructed in that period of 36 hours, all of the building blocks of basic fascist street politics right there. You create this sort of sense that you are going to be destroyed by your opposition, so therefore you have to destroy them first. You create a sense of urgency that you have to do this right now. You create a sense in which when you do seize power, then your first goal is to just destroy every single person that disagrees with you. Then you valorize the actions that are taken in order to do that, and you valorize the people that do it. What is really fascinating about this is the Nazi Party did almost exactly this. There was a guy killed during the beer hall coup attempt. I forget his name. He became immediately a martyr for the Nazi Party.
There's so many overlapping themes here that are exactly just like the beer hall putsch.
Yeah, and so he became a martyr. His picture showed up on their newspapers. He became the sort of ideal of what a stormtrooper is supposed to be. You know, he became this sort of symbol of, you know, Nazi masculinity and like all these other things.
They had a flag that the people that were involved in that attempted uprising had. And supposedly there was some blood from, you know, these martyrs that were spilled on the flag. And they would actually bring it out certain ceremonies, and they would touch the flag to, like, SS and, like, German soldiers to symbolize, you know, the blood of the martyrs. But, yeah, it became this, you know, quasi-religious experience that they would have with the military, basically connecting that attempted uprising with, you know, the state, you know, being in power.
Yeah.
And I think for them, this is something that's very much like that. This is an attempted uprising to gain their freedom. They were repressed horribly by the state. Which is hilarious when you actually like dig into it. I think at some point we're going to have somebody that was actually on the ground, on the six come on the program. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you look at the way that the Pentagon responded to it, like one of the things the Pentagon said was that they didn't want to send in National Guard troops because they didn't like the optics. I'm assuming the optics of repressing basically a bunch of like white dudes in their early 40s, you know, screaming about Trump. But anyway.
Yeah. So we end up in this situation in which Trump is saying that the only way people can save themselves is to put him back in power by doing something similar and to risk their lives in the process.
How much of that do you think is him just basically following the breadcrumbs, because that's what the conspiracy theories are saying? Like, I just saw an article where the MyPillow guy was already walking back, just like a lot of these people have, that Trump would return to office in August. Like, is he just basically looking at the tea leaves and he's like, oh, they're saying I'm going to come back in August, so let me hint at that because that's what I do.
I think that that's a really wonderful question. And I don't know if we have an answer to it. What we can say is that the rhetoric of Donald Trump and the themes that he's been pushing have veered very deep into the kind of extremist, what used to be the fringe of the Republican Party, and that that's happened over the last like 3 or 4 weeks. There's been a notable shift in the way that he's talking about things. There's been a notable shift in the way that he talks about opposition. There's been notable shift in the way that he talks about his return to power. All of that has changed really drastically. That drastic shift could be him following breadcrumbs, but on a certain level, that doesn't matter. We saw in January, like, whether or not Trump actually believes that the election was stolen is irrelevant. He told people that it was. He went and gave a speech at a rally that was themed around that, told them to march down to the Capitol, and then they tried to throw a coup to keep him in power. Like, it doesn't really matter whether he believes what he says. Just like it doesn't matter whether any dictator really believes what they say. I mean, like, there's always this kind of, there's this tendency that people have to look at dictatorships and go, oh, well, that thing that that person said is obviously ridiculous, so why would they say it? Well, there's other things at play here. Dictators don't have to be accurate. Dictators don't have to be honest. Dictators have to be powerful, right? And you can be powerful without being honest. The Soviet Union did it for decades, right? So we need to look at what's happening with Trump, not through the lens of belief or truth or anything, but purely operationally. And what is happening right now is whether or not he thinks that this is what's going on, he is creating all of the conditions for his supporters to mobilize and arm themselves up again. Now, what that means is a good question. I don't know. I think that there's a lot of questions out there about how many people that call still appeals to. I think there's a lot of questions out there about how many people are actually going to follow through with that. And I think we've seen a lot from the right wing, a lot of people talking a really big game and not following through with stuff, right? But at the same time, that is also what the DC Metro Police thought was going to happen on January 6th, that there was a lot of people just talking a big game on the internet and they weren't going to follow through because they hadn't followed through before, and then they got taken by surprise. And so we know now that Trump supporters are numerous enough to be able to cause deadly situations to play out. We know that they are willing to do that. We know that they are willing to die and kill in that process. And now they're being told that they shouldn't wait till 2024, that really they should rise up right now and try and put Trump back in power in August. Now, if nothing else happens, I will almost guarantee that a level of political violence will result from that. Not the interesting kind, but the really sad type of political violence that's sort of operated socially as a way to force people out of social space, right? Like the kind of violence that the right wing engages in, which is about social exclusion, ethnic cleansing. We are very likely to see an uptick in that around this idea. Trump has shown absolutely zero motivation to pull back on this. He's, for whatever reason. And, you know, at this point, because he's out of the news so often now, we can't really pay attention to every single thing that's going on with him. I think it's a lot harder to posit motivation here, which is another reason why I don't think that we have to worry about thought or truth or motivation. I think we have to worry about is the material operational reality that it creates.
There's no way that Trump is going to, like, magically get into office. I know they play all these mental gymnastics in their mind that, like, you know, about legal this and constitution that and, like, because of this and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I mean, that's all just fantasy.
But that's where I think the shift is, though. They stopped talking about all of that. There's no more laws. There's not elections in this narrative. There's just the return to power, right? That's really different because that indicates the desire to essentially inaugurate a dictatorship, right? Like, that is what they want. Now, that seems like it comes out of nowhere. I think if you were like 10 years ago and someone was telling you that what was going on today is happening, you wouldn't believe it because things did accelerate really fast. However, if you really follow conservative culture carefully, this is the playing out of a fantasy that has existed in conservative culture for a really long time. It's this playing out of this fantasy in which communists have taken control, and that it's up to the, you know, glorious patriots of, you know, the American public to pick up guns and rise up and save America from their enemies, right? Like, this was the plot of Red Dawn. I mean, like, there's whole movies made with this back plot. So it's like, on some level, it seems almost unbelievable, but on another level, January 6th felt like it was going, if that would have happened 10 years ago, would have felt unbelievable as well, right?
I guess what I'm saying is, like, I'm more worried about possible just random or organized far-right violence than I am about them, like, storming some empty building and being like, we've won.
Yes. Well, let me just be the first one to say, they're not going to win. The basic premise of the sort of militia fantasy that they're going to take on the U.S. government in some, like, frontal conflict is, suicide, right? It just is. It's not a thing that functions in the 21st century at all. Even for the basic reason that the U.S. government has an air force and, like, nukes and stuff. Right? That revolts have to happen really differently now. Things can't really function that way anymore. There's modern surveillance and aircraft and stuff, right? But they have this fantasy. And that fantasy was the same fantasy that motivated Timothy McVeigh, right? That same fantasy motivated Randy Weaver. That same fantasy, in some ways, in a sort of slightly different appropriation of it, motivated David Koresh, right? So, they did an episode of the Fever Dreams podcast, which is Daily Beast's podcast about right-wing politics. It's really good. And they had an author on, and I'm blanking on her name right now, and I really wish I knew who it was because she's doing some really interesting work. But she was drawing a lot of parallels, actually, to the Turner Diaries. So for those of you that don't know, the Turner Diaries was a book written by William Pierce. William Pierce is dead now, but he used to be the head of the National Alliance. He also used to be a nuclear physicist, right? And so this is a person who is very well read, who knows how to write, who has resources, right? And so he writes this book called The Turner Diaries and self-publishes it. And it's this book that is incredibly influential on the right wing. You'll sometimes find copies of it at things like gun shows and stuff. Timothy McVeigh was used to sell copies of the Turner Diaries at gun shows, actually before the Oklahoma City bombing. And it's this book which is about this sort of small group of people which starts a racist uprising in America. And in the process, engages in just unchecked, wanton murder. Like, there's scenes of mass casualty events in the book. There's scenes of buildings getting blown up and descriptions of the mangled bodies. There's scenes of executions. There's a scene where they attack the Capitol. And in the process of attacking the Capitol, they raise a gallows outside of the Capitol, which is exactly what happened on January 6th, that exact same thing. And they then proceed to do things like kill every single person in Asia. And every single person in Africa, right? And nuke the entire American South after, of course, having all the white people leave, right? Like, it's a really violent, over-the-top book, but it's really, really influential on the right wing. And the Turner Diaries tends to be this book that becomes influential on the right wing when a certain political shift happens. And that political shift is a shift away from feeling like you're making headway, making inertia in the kind of culture war, to feeling like you're losing again. And what's happening right now on the right wing is, I mean, you're seeing it with evangelicals, you're seeing it with certain wings of the Republican Party. There is a certain kind of desperation taking over, and the things that are being said are getting increasingly extreme and increasingly baseless, and increasingly sort of focused on this idea that this is the make it or break it, end of the world kind of moment, right? When you add all of that together, when you add together this idea of a sort of, you know, religious adherence to an individual person, along with this idea that there is this absolute existential social division that can only be resolved by eliminating half the country, when you add that onto a sort of, you know, assumption that democracy is never going to, quote, democracy is never going to go your way, right? That you're going to lose elections and things like that. When you add all of that together and you add in the culture of the right wing already as it exists, and what tends to happen in the right wing when they start losing, that is a recipe for a significant amount of political violence, potentially. I don't think the concern needs to be that they're going to take power. I think the concern, much more modestly, is that they're going to attack people. They might attack state capitals. I could see them trying to attack county offices. But they're going to attack people. They're going to attack Planned Parenthood offices, very likely, or Democratic Party functions. Like, things like this, which have been soft targets for the right wing in the past.
And to be clear, like, taking power in, like, a state level.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of taking power, even just, like, taking up space and, like, you know, either in terms of, like, small towns or, like, on school boards or on city councils and stuff like that. I mean, we're already seeing them throw their weight around, like, you know, going to a school and yelling about critical race theory or something like that. So I can see them amplifying that to the nth degree.
Well, they already are. I mean, and this isn't just what I would consider to be the conservative movement. They've done this for a long time. They've encouraged people to run in local races. And we'll talk about voter ID laws and voter suppression in a second, because that's actually the level where that becomes most impactful. It's not on the state or federal level. It's actually on these local levels. And so they've been doing this for a long time. What has shifted, though, is that elements of the extreme right wing are starting to do this, right? So, like, white nationalists outside of people like David Duke and Pat Buchanan tended to not do electoral politics, right? I mean, we've seen them do it more now, recently. You're seeing all of these, like, people from the alt-right running for office and blah, blah, blah. But that is a relatively new phenomenon in the kind of contemporary political climate in America. That's not a thing that really existed before that. And so you see, like, elements of that that are really, I mean, they're starting to organize over Telegram channels to do things like run coordinated electoral campaigns, right? Things like that. You're also watching it happen with QAnon. I forgot what the number is, but there's something like 60-something QAnon candidates for Congress, just Congress, that are running just right now. Okay, now most of those will never make it out of the primaries. They're going to lose to another Republican. But the fact that there are 64 candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives that are firmly entrenched within QAnon says something, right? It really points to a degree of focus. It really points to a strategic shift. QAnon people have also been talking about running for school boards, right? So, like, they're taking a well-worn path in the conservative movement, which is to really go after these kind of local offices. But at the same time, the rhetoric has shifted. And that rhetoric has this element of pessimism to it, which I think is really relevant and will help us kind of transition into talking about voter suppression. But conservative politics today, in 2021, is largely pessimistic. That it's not a narrative of victory right now. It's not a narrative of, you know, triumph or overcoming, right? It is a narrative of losing. It's a narrative of failure, right? It's a narrative of disempowerment and complaint and grievance. We see people like Tucker Carlson just running with it, right? Just like seeing that this is a thing and just running with it and shifting his rhetoric as a result. Right. Tucker Carlson is now no longer talking about how the great glorious MAGA future is coming, but is now talking about how, like, some person on the school board is trying to destroy America or something like that. Right.
The thing I keep thinking about is, like you said, like, they kind of, like, are going, like, down and down and down and down into this rabbit hole. And it's like, at what point does this stuff just become so far removed from reality? Like, if you're literally talking about somebody with, like, minimal amount of power, they're going to destroy your life because they want to, like, read To Kill a Mockingbird in school or something like that. Or, you know, like, mention that the civil rights movement actually existed. Or, hey, maybe slavery wasn't that great of a thing. To even conservatives or just people that would vote for Trump, does this just get to the point where it's like, this is just so far removed from, like, the average reality, which has really nothing to do with any of the stuff they're talking about. Like, does this stop animating the base of just, like, being important? Because they keep they really are, just like the whole, you know, Antifa craze or whatever, they're really manufacturing kind of this, like, hysteria around this. I guess, like, how far will that go? I mean, so far it seems to be working for them, but...
Kinda. It's kinda working, but it's kinda not. And I think that there's a lot of elements here that have shifted from traditional politics, and a lot of them center around the internet. So, on one level, it's can be very difficult for people to even gain enough of an understanding to understand that the thing that they're saying is divorced from reality. That at this point, a lot of people exist in information echo chambers, whether those echo chambers are on Facebook or Fox News or whatever, OAN. And the only thing they hear is repetition over and over and over again. That repetition has been so thick in the recent past that what's happened to a lot of these people is that it's realigned all of their assumptions about how life works, right? That it's not just that all of a sudden the state is coming after Donald Trump for some reason, but it's that that's always what happens. That the U.S. state is always run by awful people and they're always coming after us. And we always, you know, and so it creates this very binary sort of view of the world within an echo chamber. And a lot of people don't leave those as a result. But the echo chamber also exists in the world. And what we're seeing a little bit of is we're starting to see some pushback on local levels when people do things like create a controversy out of nothing about critical race theory, which is not a thing that's taught in elementary schools or middle schools or most high schools, and in which most of the people that were complaining about don't even know what it is, right? They manufactured this thing, but what happened? All these people showed up at school board meetings and they start screaming racist stuff at school board members on camera. And there have been reports from all over the country. The New York Times did a whole article about this last week. There have been other outlets have done articles about this. But the people that are yelling racist stuff at these meetings are shocked when all of their friends stop talking to them because their friends weren't there. How would they know about it? Well, of course, some put it on Facebook. And like these people don't really understand how the internet works, apparently. And so the idea that they can say an awful thing and then everyone's going to know that they said an awful thing, I think is a thing that a lot of normal MAGA supporters are just really starting to come to terms with. Now, there were definitely MAGA supporters in the suburbs that came to terms with this earlier. We saw elements of that during the election. But in a lot of parts of the U.S., people only really exist around people who have pretty similar political and social outlooks as them. Whether that's, you know, you're living in a city and you're surrounded by liberals or you're living out in the middle of nowhere in, you know, Kansas and you're surrounded by Christian conservatives, like whatever it happens to be. And so there's this kind of assumption that you can say stuff within that space. And if you're not like an overt white supremacist, if you're not Richard Spencer, then people aren't going to come after you because, you know, you're just like some old person who like really likes Donald Trump and watches too much OAN, right? But they're starting to face social consequences for this. And that creates a depressing effect. It creates this effect in which all of a sudden, if you notice, there's not many protests about critical race theory now. That whole craze lasted like 2 months. That's it. That's all they got out of that. They got 2 months of culture war, like sort of fuel, essentially, and in the process alienated a lot of people because the argument that they had to make was just on a basic overt level, just obscenely racist. And they went with it anyways. And so you have this depressing effect happening because there is a blowback from the Trump years. But also, that's coupled with the fact that there's factionalization happening on the right wing, where different elements of the right wing no longer talk to each other, and the MAGA coalition isn't enough to hold them together. And they're not in power anymore. And so, because they're not in power, because Trump is not on the news every single day, he does not have the ability to drive that outrage machine. That essentially, the outrage machine has to start driving itself. And it's been having problems doing that. The controversies that they've come up with are ridiculous. They're obviously ridiculous. And the one that had the most sort of inertia behind it was a critical race theory quote, controversy, which made them look really overtly racist. And so the normal MAGA supporter now, I think that this is really kind of a giant X factor, right? One of two things is going to happen. Either the MAGA crowd is going to radicalize more, which there are definitely elements that are doing that, right? You're seeing a lot more MAGA people start to mimic the language of sovereign citizens. You're seeing MAGA people being anti-Semitic overtly, right? You're seeing them talk about QAnon, right? Like, there already is a bit of a crossover there, right? And so, you know, there are people that are going to go in more extreme directions, and we're already seeing that. And I'm not talking about a small number. I mean, we're talking thousands of people are heading in that direction. All you need to do is jump on any right-wing Telegram channel and you can see that. But at the same time, there's another faction of MAGA world, which I think is going to have a really hard time continuing to keep going. That's the part of MAGA world that was motivated primarily by things like Trump promising to bring the coal jobs back, or promising to, you know, raise wages or build infrastructure, things like that.
See, this is another interesting thing, is that, you know, Biden said something like 5 years ago, which I thought was interesting and it's worth talking about. He said, I want the Democrats to talk about race every day, because the more they talk about race, the more we can crush them with, you know, he didn't say this, but essentially class issues.
Yeah.
He framed it as, you know, America first, economic nationalism.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You said that they basically lost those people, and that seems to be something that Trump doesn't really talk about anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, like, remember when Trump said things like, we're going to turn the Republican Party into a workers' party.
Yeah.
I mean, he totally contradicts himself and then turn around and say, like, I only hire rich people. You know, I mean, like, it was never a coherent strategy, but he was smart enough to basically at least sprinkle that in there, some sort of like populist, like, you know, oh, maybe like we really will be the elites that care about, you know, the white working class or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, I mean, if you look at his track record in actual politics, I mean, it's an obvious sham.
Yeah.
And I think it's hilarious these white nationalists like Nick Fuentes continue to, like, you know, make it seem like the Republican Party offers anybody, you know, let alone white working class people, anything other than some, like, you know, the psychology boost of, you know, whiteness.
Yeah.
But I guess my point is like, yeah, I think it's important to point out that, like you said, they haven't really kind of like hampered on that America first, economic nationalism kind of thing. Because, I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything there. They don't seem to be offering anything. Like, what are they offering to those people that, you know, want the coal jobs back?
Yeah, nothing. I mean, what they're presenting instead is, and you can, it's really transparent how they're doing this. What they're presenting instead is the same thing they were saying in 2015, right? Like, Trump is literally going back to the stuff he was saying in 2015, that immigrants are taking your jobs and murdering your children. And, you know, we really need to, like, you know, really cut down on crime, because the cities are smoking hell holes where people are just getting murdered in the streets all the time. You know, and just, he puts forward this vision of what the quote other America looks like.
Which, again, sells to some people.
Yes.
In the suburbs that are like terrified of Black Lives Matter or something like that, or like don't want to go to Chicago because of reasons or something. But I mean, to the people in the communities impacted by neoliberalism, like in the Rust Belt, the, like, you know, voted for Obama, then voted for Trump, then went back and voted for Biden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really see them being, like, sold by the snake oil. There's actually a lot of resentment against Trump. I mean, we're talking in general here, but I mean, there's actually been a fair amount of, like, good, like, you know, small documentaries and news pieces on this. I mean, like, I remember one where some guy at a plant and, like, you know, Appalachia was just said, he's like, look, I don't care what bathroom you use. Like, I just want my family to be fed.
Yeah.
And Trump is talking about jobs, and we've already had, you know, all these years of Clinton, and look where it got us, you know, NAFTA, free trade, blah, blah, blah. If Trump is going to bring my job back, then I'm going to vote for him.
Yeah.
But of course we saw where that went. It was just more of the same.
Well, and I think there's a tendency amongst people on the quote left and kind of like concurrent, sort of political currents, to really not think of voters as people which have complex reasons for voting in a certain way. And they do. I mean, you go around to factories in a place like Youngstown, Ohio, right? And you talk to people there. And this has been done. Tim Ryan, who's the U.S. House rep for that district that contains Youngstown, has talked about this very openly. He says, look, I go down onto the street, I do a town hall meeting, I talk about NAFTA, and everyone in that room knows what I'm talking about. Everybody. Right? There's not a single person there that could not tell you what NAFTA stands for and what it did. Right? And like, being a person who lives in the Rust Belt, that is also my experience too. Right? The people around me, formal education level or not, right? Like, a lot of people around me never graduated high school. But regardless of formal level of education, they have relatively complex ways of thinking about the world that are really well informed and incredibly coherent. And generally, all moving in a very specific kind of political direction. And it's not just that people are sort of knee-jerk reacting, voting for the first person that says, you know, I'm going to give you jobs. It's that they're doing that on the back of 30 years of the Democrats telling them the same thing and failing, right? That's the thing that people need to pay attention to. So, like, the Democratic Party loves to blame, you know, ulterior causes. Like, they will say Trump got elected because racism, or Trump got elected because of voter suppression, or things like, sure, like, those are elements, absolutely. But what you never hear the Democratic Party say, ever, is we failed working people for the last 40 years. And so, of course, they went and voted for somebody else. They can't admit the failure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we've said before and other people have pointed out, you know, the kind of like mirage of issues that the Democrats kind of present as their platform and like, you know, what they're about is literally the world that they helped construct. You know, it's like, you know, mass incarceration, mass austerity, the immense funding of police and prisons, border militarization, you know, massive free trade agreements, you know, things like NAFTA, you know, the neoliberalization of the economy, the creation of basically a new funding source for the Democratic Party to exist in, you know, Silicon Valley and technology, this sort of, you know, like soft coastal elite. I mean, there is, you know, some like reality in this, these kind of tropes.
Yeah. Well, and the stuff that is manufactured, most of it, not the critical race theory stuff or things like that. And I think that this is becoming less and less the case every day, but most of what gets manufactured at least has a foundation in something, right? So let's take the Buy America campaigns, which is a great example of like the mass adoption of conspiracy theory. The union, specifically the AFL-CIO and the UAW, went out and said, because of NAFTA, foreigners are stealing your jobs, right? Now, that did happen to some degree or another, but since the 70s, only 4% of American jobs in total have been lost to outsourcing, right? So it's not a huge number. 70% of the net job loss in America since the 70s has been because of automation. Now, of course, the unions were in a weird place in relation to automation because automation was something they themselves argued for too, because it's safer. And it creates safer working conditions. And it means workers have to get trained, which makes their pay higher. Like, there are reasons why business unions, right? Not radical unions, but business unions would find something like automation, potentially something that not only is acceptable, but something that they're able to use, right? But what did they say? They didn't say, oh, it's all this automation. Maybe you all should go back to community college, take some computer classes. We'll pay for it, blah, blah. No, they said people in Mexico are taking your jobs. And people believed that for a while. I think that there was a pretty wide recognition in a lot of parts of the Rust Belt. People did believe that. That's become less true today. But people at the time really did believe that. And that led to racist attacks in otherwise generally pretty progressive areas that led to, you know, white union workers starting to get a lot more conservative, that led to this kind of misunderstanding of how economics works, right? All of that was a result of that resentment, but that resentment was grounded, or at least started its life, on a foundation of something, which was people were losing jobs and their pay was getting cut.
Right. I mean, if you go back, I mean, there's a really great interview we did with an anarchist that was involved in the anti-globalization movement. And they were in Vermont and they were involved in a lot of like kind of, you know, class war politics, you know, involved in unions, supporting strikes. And, you know, the way they talk about the anti-globalization period at that time was that unions had a very central role in that. I mean, they were coming out to demonstrations. They were opposing these big trade deals. They were protesting things like the World Trade Organization, you know, and they were kind of in this wider coalition that involved environmentalists, anarchists, you know, trade unions, nonprofits, all that stuff, you know, people involved in, you know, the social movements, you know, college kids protesting sweatshops on their campus, so on and so forth. So they were coming from, you know, an economic and social and political left position against global capital, even if that's kind of like how they probably wouldn't describe it as such. But as things progress and these things, you know, were passed, they took on more and more reactionary and nationalist tone, like you were saying. And even when Trump came into office, you could see some of the AFL-CIO people, you know, sat at the table with Trump and said, like, maybe we can get something out of this. His rhetoric sounds a lot like our rhetoric.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean,
which was the rhetoric of basically pitting workers against each other. I mean, it's not like the slogan or the statement itself, like, you know, immigrants stole our jobs, as if the immigrants somehow are taking, quote, your jobs, or even if under capitalism you're guaranteed a job. I mean, that's so idiotic. Like, the system doesn't guarantee you employment at all. No. It guarantees you nothing. You know, you're just a single person with your labor to sell on the open marketplace. And if somebody's going to sell it for cheaper, why shouldn't the capitalists go there? That's how capitalism works.
Right. Right.
I mean, again, like this whole idea that people are somehow guaranteed something and that this other group of people somehow stole from them is just like comes right out of settler colonial mentality. Oh, sure. that people are owed something because they stole this land from somebody else.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's been a downward spiral of, you know, into a regressive reactionary nationalist position.
Yes.
that Trump has echoed.
And I think what's important about that sort of slight diversion from the conversation that we've been on for a few minutes now, but what's really important about that is if we actually do understand people as people with political knowledge and interests, right, and concerns, then all of a sudden we can start to see MAGA world really differently, and we can start to understand this sort of divorcing from reality in a different light and understand the implications differently. So if there was a solid chunk of Trump supporters in 2016 who were union workers and suburbanites who wanted low taxes and stuff like that, like moderate conservatives and all of that, those people are out of the MAGA coalition now. They are no longer a part of what's going on. Now, those are voters who tend to vote based on material considerations. Right. They're voting based on wanting to feed their kids, right? Healthcare, you know, needing the ability to retire one day, you know, like really basic nuts and bolts kind of household management stuff, right? Which is really, if you ask most Americans what they care about, that is actually the stuff that they do primarily care about, even if that's the smallest part of the conversation domestically. So those people, though, are not so much subject in the same way to the echo chamber in the way that other MAGA supporters are. And what we've noticed with that group of people very specifically is that they drifted away from Trump, starting with Charlottesville, and it moved from there. And that process accelerated over time. As those people started to look at the distance between reality and what they were being told, they left in increasing numbers, right? So who was left at the end were traditional conservatives, right? So people who are like, you know, evangelicals or, you know, like pro-business people or whatever, right? Kind of traditional conservatives still voted for him. And then the actual MAGA crowd. So what's left of the MAGA crowd? And I think that we touched on this a bit earlier. So we've got one faction of the MAGA crowd, which is, you know, pretty interested still in sort of electoral politics and, like, trying to win midterm elections and stuff like that. And you have this other faction, which has left that world entirely, is no longer focused on winning through the normal mechanisms of the political system, is deeply, deeply pessimistic right now, really, really, really well-armed, and being actively encouraged by their sort of god-king figure to go out and put him in power permanently. That is all relatively dangerous. Now, what that means, though, is that the more and more and more they push in that direction, the further and further and further away they're getting from the reality that the rest of us live in, and you're not likely to pull in supporters from that position, right? You're also not likely to ever build up enough support or enough strength, resources, inertia to be able to actually functionally overthrow the U.S. state, right? That's not something I'd be really worried about. But they will have enough capacity to attack things and attack people. We are already seeing indications of this. I mean, there's already been a number of people since January 6th that have been arrested in, like, various plots, or someone that got arrested, like, flipped on somebody else, and the feds found out about, like, the pipe bombs in their basement. Like, there's been a number of those things that have already happened since January 6th. Up until this point, all those people have been caught before they were able to do the thing that they were planning on doing. But we all know that eventually that's not going to be the result. We need to pay really careful attention to this. Because even if they can't seize power, there are enough MAGA people with enough guns and enough motivation. And I'm not even talking hundreds of thousands. I'm talking tens of thousands. To make life really difficult for everybody else. Tens of thousands of people picking up guns and attacking the social space and the political space is incredibly disruptive to the rest of our lives. And it's a thing which will likely impact communities that many of us are a part of very directly. That MAGA people aren't going to go out and attack something in their town. They're going to drive to the nearest major city or the most symbolic major city and do it there. Because that's what they've been told to do. And that's what they've been convinced is the right thing to do. That is what changed at CPAC. We saw all of that come out in its full glory right in front of us. We've been able to watch the reactions since then. We've been able to see the conversations that have played out since that point. And Trump's message, again, whether he believes it or not, was heard loud and clear by at least a faction of MAGA world that has sort of left any sort of concept of participating in the political system.
Well, should we go on to how this intersects with other stuff?
Yeah, let's do voter suppression laws quick. Because okay. There's not a ton to really talk about. Talk about the filibuster in 5 minutes and then end.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the next piece of this is how this ties into voter suppression laws. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could do a whole overview of state by state. We're not going to do that. But I think the big questions are, what are they hoping to get out of this? Is this just more red meat to the base? Like, is this actually a strategy to win, to stay in power? And also, too, like, will this work? Like, will this actually get Republicans in office?
Yeah. So let's start with the second question. Will this work? Because I think that this is probably the core question to answer if we're going to understand what's going on here. Because the answer is on a federal or state level? No, it's not. Those elections are decided by many thousands of votes, right? There have been a lot of studies done on voter suppression, and they found that things like voter ID laws and stuff like that might depress turnout by maybe 1%, maybe 2%. Now, in states where things are very close, that's meaningful. But if we look at the last presidential election, for example, there wasn't a state that was that close. No state was within that margin. The result would have been exactly the same, right? Same with any of the state elections. The result would have been the same. I think there was one seat, I think it was maybe a U.S. House seat that came down to a couple hundred votes or something like that. That might have been impacted by that, but like we're talking real thin margins here, right? So these kinds of laws are incredibly effective on a local level, though. So as we talked about earlier, conservatives and also conspiracy theorists are starting to really, and neo-Nazis for that matter, are starting to really hone in on this idea of local politics for those that are still toying around with the political system. And the reason is actually pretty simple. If you actually look at the amount of people that vote in, like, your local school board election, or vote for anyone in the school board election, we're talking a very, very, very small percentage of people. In the city I live in, voter turnout for local elections is under 10%, because there's no point, because, you know, the same people have run the city forever, and there's really no point, and people feel kind of systematically disempowered. But even for those that turn up and vote, they don't always vote in things like, you know, school board elections and stuff. And so often those races are decided by, you know, very thin slivers of 50 votes, 100 votes, something like that. With the way that they're doing voter suppression right now, and just for context, there's somewhere around 40-something voter suppression laws that are currently being debated, many more that are being proposed, and some that have already been passed. So, like, this isn't, and it's happening in, like, 30-something states. Like, this isn't a fringe thing that's just happening in a couple of places. Like, this is an organized endeavor, right? They very obviously are using the election conspiracy as a motivator for that. They've been pretty transparent about that. They've been saying things like, well, I mean, whether or not you think that election was stolen, we want to make sure that no elections get stolen, you know, and they're very clearly, like, playing off this idea that people thought that the election was stolen to justify this. So on this, like, very local level, these kinds of things are pretty meaningful. But on a bigger state and federal level, they tend to not be as meaningful. Doesn't mean that there's no impact. But the impact tends to be a little bit smaller. Let's take a race for, like, governor in a moderately sized state. You know, you might have 15 or 20 million people vote in that race. The shaving of 1,000 votes here and there often is not decisive. And what we've seen in a lot of parts of America so far is that politics is actually really solidified into really clear lines, right? And you can see this if you look at a county-by-county political map. You know, liberals are clustered around cities almost entirely, and conservatives are clustered outside of cities almost entirely. There's very little overlap. I mean, most cities are pretty consistently Democratic. And so you're seeing this kind of, on some level, process which really doesn't have any purpose, right? On a political level. If areas are already pretty solidly political one direction or another, most local elections are already decided. Right? Before anyone does anything. You might be able to squeak away a win in an election that you didn't run against anyone in, that, like, no one ran for the seat, or maybe you ran against some, like, fringy candidate. They might be able to squeak out a seat here and there. But even on those races, voter suppression laws are very unlikely to have, like, huge meaningful impact. So why are they doing this? And I think what's happened here is something that's really fascinating. So we have to think about first the primary motivation for this, right? And then we have to think about what has happened. So the primary motivation for voter suppression is as old as America, right? There have always been attempts to do voter suppression. Sometimes those took the form of, you know, I mean, there were stories from, like, the early 19th century where, like, people from political party would, like, walk into a neighborhood that was, you know, really, you know, had a lot of opposition party supporters, and they take everyone to the bar and get them completely drunk so they wouldn't go vote. Right? Like, stuff like that happens. Or the opposite, Tammany Hall in New York City used to buy people alcohol and then send them to the polls, right? These are really common. Edgar Allan Poe, for example, died on election day in Baltimore because he got fed so much alcohol during the day that he was sick and his body just broke down and just fell apart. He, like, died on election night. Because the political parties had gotten them so drunk throughout the day. So, like, this is a really common thing throughout American history. And there have been lots of things done to sort of try and prevent that from happening. Now, those attempts have kind of shifted over time. In the early 20th, mid-20th century, and up through the Kennedy administration very specifically, that shift was one which was targeting sort of institutional corruption, right? This idea that an entire institution, like a city government, would rig an election overtly to stay in power, right? And that has been largely stopped. There are not really any examples in contemporary America of that happening. So why are Republicans still pushing this? Well, they're pushing this based on a basic shift in the rhetoric around voter suppression. What they're saying is, look, election fraud is not a thing that we have to deal with on a governmental level. Election fraud is something we have to deal with on an individual level. That it's individual voters that are committing voter fraud. And so, but might be doing it in coordination with each other. So we have to target individuals, not governments. Okay, that's the argument that they're making. Now, Republicans have been making this argument ever since the Civil Rights Act was passed. And they've been making this argument based on a creeping demographic reality, which is that they have been losing supporters for decades. To, you know, the millennial generation, very few of us are conservative. Any generations past ours. You know, they've been losing support, and that loss of support has been increasing in speed over time. We entered the reality about 30 years ago in which the Republican Party started winning elections by losing elections, which is this really weird phenomenon that can happen in America because of the way that districts are drawn, electoral districts are drawn. You can lose the popular vote and still win elections. We saw that happen in presidential elections with Bush. We saw that happen with Trump. We also have seen things like this sort of happen on a federal level with the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. Pretty normal that Democrats get a lot more votes than Republicans do in Senate and House elections when you take those votes in aggregate. That is even the case in state elections where Republicans still run a state. They will lose the popular vote in that state. That is often because when they drew districts last time, they grouped tens of thousands of people in a city into one district, and then there would be a tiny little district that was mostly Republican that might have like 5,000 people in it. And they drew the districts in such a way as to concentrate Democratic votes and distribute Republican votes. And so they're able to hold these supermajorities on a state level, in ways that are sort of far outsized from their actual level of support. And they can do this for a while. They have been doing this for a while. They've been doing it for 30 years. However, what has been going on is that even in light of all of that, the margins in which they're able to squeak out sort of bureaucratic victories is shrinking really to almost an infinitesimal level, right? A level which is almost imperceptible. And they are losing elections now, even with the rules that they largely wrote in states like Arizona and Colorado and places like this. And so voter suppression laws can win you a local election, but that's not really the purpose. The purpose is other. And in this case, I would say the purpose is kind of twofold. The first is it mobilizes people, right? You convince people that they just participated in an election that got stolen. It makes them real mad, right? We can see that everywhere right now, with election conspiracy still being a thing that people sort of adhere to. Those people are upset. I mean, they might be upset for a completely fictional reason, but that doesn't make them not mad. Like, they're pretty mad about this. And so that motivates them. They're going to show up. They're going to run for the school board. They're going to do these things, right? They're going to show up at school board meetings. And we've been seeing this to some degree or another. That mentality amongst the Republican Party is just another part of the kind of constantly rolling outrage machine, that sometimes elements of that outrage machine turn into legislation or turn into legislative action, like the Arizona, quote, recount, which is still going on, by the way. That was a legislative action born out of concern that people had based on nothing, right? And so they're able to kind of continue to do this, right? They're able to use things like voter suppression or what they would say fair elections, quote, unquote, to mobilize their base. And they're doing this in a really fascinating way right now. which I think is the thing that we have been seeing a bit of, but it becomes really clear in this instance. So they have been on this, you know, sort of crusade against voting, for lack of a better term, for many decades already, as we've said. However, they have started really increasing the pace of this over the course of the last 10 years or so. So pretty much ever since, well, maybe longer than that, it'd be 13 years now. So pretty much ever since George W. Bush left office, there's been a really intense attempt to pass increasing numbers of voter suppression laws. And that is a part of the general kind of culture war rhetoric that exists within the Republican Party. And so they're able to mobilize people that way. But what happened this time is they went, okay, Democrats prevented us from doing voter suppression in the past. That led to this election getting stolen, which means that we need to do voter suppression to stop an election from getting stolen because that election was stolen. And it becomes this tautological narrative where there's no actual evidence of any meaningful voter fraud. I think three or four people have been charged with voter fraud, and three of those, like the plurality of those, were Trump supporters. It's not a thing which happens frequently. And so they're doing this as a way to kind of keep people coming out. Voter suppression laws do have a chilling effect. And so there are people that won't come out, not because they can't vote, but because they think they can't. That definitely exists. Conservatives get court fights out of this, right? Someone will challenge the law. They get to go to court, make a big deal about it by doing press conferences and things like that. And so this becomes part of the outrage machine, right? And that was working for a pretty long time. And I would say that there's an element in which it still kind of functions. Like, people are still motivated by voter suppression.
Sure. But I guess the fear is that, like, even if what you say is correct, that, like, a few of them might slip through and win because of this, and that they're going to go on to then install Trump as dictator for life.
That's not going to happen. Like... Yeah, there's no way that that happens. I think that the more likely reality is actually potentially more disturbing in some ways, right? And that is that what the Republican Party has done systematically is delegitimize elections amongst their own base, while at the same time asking them to come out and vote. We saw what happened in Georgia during the Senate elections when this contradiction played itself out. You had Lynn Wood going up on stage telling people not to vote because why would you vote in a rigged election system? And then you have the Republican Party screaming at people to go out and vote, even though Lynn Wood said that at a rally for a Republican candidate. Like, it's this really over-the-top, kind of ridiculous sort of reality that exists in this world. And so I think the more likely outcome here is that the rhetoric is going to shift again. Voter suppression laws are not likely to ultimately be successful. Most voter suppression laws get shot down or at least heavily curtailed in the courts. That has been the experience of the recent past. Some of them are able to hold, but really, the ones that would be, like, really meaningful, the ones that would really actually suppress votes in a meaningful way, never pass court review, right? They never pass court challenge. But when they fail a court challenge, conservatives have started doing this new thing. And you saw this with people like James O'Keefe, right, from Project Veritas, but other conservatives have started doing this too. And you saw this with the Trump campaign. They lose a court battle. And they don't go, oh, well, rule of law dictates that we're wrong. Okay, let's move on, which is like what they would have done 20 years ago. Now they go, the courts are stacked with radical left Democrats who are part of the communist conspiracy, and they delegitimize the court system. Then. So they delegitimize voting, but they want people to vote. They delegitimize the court system, but they claim to love police, right? And in this process of delegitimization, what you're going to see is exactly what we're starting to see emerge. That the real hardcore fascist tendency on the right wing kind of prior to January 6th was one which existed within QAnon and the militia movement and neo-Nazis and things like this, but not necessarily as the overtly held position of most normal MAGA supporters, right? Who did think that they were trying to prevent the election from getting stolen, even if they were being mobilized to carry out a coup. They thought that what they were doing was a democratic act, right? There is a faction of people within that that are going to drift away from this, but that number is not likely to be very big because of these political echo chambers. What is more likely to happen is that increasingly these people are going to decide that the electoral system is not how they win, And we already saw that at CPAC. We've been talking about it already for a lot of this show. But the Republican Party is sort of entering into this really dangerous kind of endgame phase. They very clearly are getting desperate. You see this amongst evangelicals. You see this amongst conspiracy theorists. You see this amongst militia people. The things that they're saying are getting more outrageous. The things that they're saying are bigger and bigger stretches, right? They're less and less connected to an observable phenomenon. And as that sort of continues to proceed, what's been created over the last 6 decades or so is this idea that, again, that conservatives are the real America and everyone else is trying to destroy America. When you are not able to be successful in the ballot box to save, quote, save America, the idea of America in this narrative is a universal concept, right? So it's not an idea which is variable based on the outcomes of elections. It's actually something that's really similar to, say, the way that religious extremists in Iran see the role of, you know, clerics in relation to the state. And they will say, okay, well, there's law, but then there's God's law, and that is above everything else. And so if God's law contradicts democracy, democracy, quote, democracy, electoral democracy, is the thing that gets eliminated, right? Because there is this universal truth that they have declared exists, and everything that contradicts that is wrong and bad needs to be destroyed. So you could vote in Iran, but only kind of, right? And there's no possibility of being able to say, vote for a prime minister in Iran that is going to undo the regime of the clerics. It's not going to happen because the clerics will just destroy the parliamentary system. We're seeing something similar play itself out here. And this is, I mean, also, I mean, going back to Tankies, this is also how democratic, quote, democratic centralism works, where you sort of have this universal concept that exists in the case of Leninism, it's historical materialism, and everything that contradicts that is wrong and bad needs to be destroyed. But they vote and stuff, but only for communists, because no one else can run because all those people are wrong and bad and need to be destroyed. It's a completely ridiculous idea. That's what's happening here. That the MAGA crowd is taking on the same political structure as Leninism or as theocracy. That they are essentially starting to make the argument that however they define those ideals, because they're not particularly well defined, right? However they define sort of Trumpian politics, they define that as true. They define everything else as false and bad and things that need to be destroyed. And so therefore, on the own terms of their own rhetoric, dictatorship is the only possibility. This is the thing that's disturbing here. It's not that the Republican Party is doing what most political parties do in, say, a parliamentary system, say, like France or England or Italy or something like that, when they start to lose support. In those contexts, the various factions of the party tend to go different directions. They form new parties and run for office again, right? What the Republican Party is doing is entirely different from that. They're sitting there saying, okay, we're going to lose in the future, right? That we're going to take all these measures to try and forestall that inevitability, but it's going to come. And when that inevitability comes, the only possible solution is to destroy electoral democracy. That is literally the position of the Republican Party as it stands today. That it's not that the voter suppression laws are this kind of anti-democratic act, right? I mean, they are a way to prevent a certain number of people from showing up to vote, but you also have to keep in mind states and democratic acts are not the same things. And so electing our authoritarian, electing our dictators, is not democracy in any kind of meaningful way, right? But that is what people think is. And so when that sort of idea, which necessitates there being multiple different understandings of the world that are sort of in a, quote, marketplace of ideas in relation to each other, when someone comes forward and says, this is a universal truth, none of that matters anymore. And so you continue to exist within the electoral system, within that mindset, as long as you're able to continue to win. But when you don't, then you're justified in destroying everything that stopped you from winning. That's the dangerous thing. That is where people like David Frum, who wrote a piece for The Atlantic today, and a few other really well-respected, generally pretty moderate, not particularly, hyperbolic, sort of political commentators have been coming forward and saying, look, this is the actual beginnings of fascist politics. It's not just that they're racist. It's not just that they're talking about, you know, building a police state or fortifying the border or any of these other things. It's not that they're, you know, really taking positions which are sort of concurrent to or very much in line with fascism. What is happening now is that the Republican Party is literally, not figuratively, not hyperbolically, but literally becoming a fascist political party. That is the thing that we need to be paying attention to. Because it's not that they're going to be successful, necessarily, but the idea that millions of Americans would attempt to impose a dictatorship through force of arms is something that we need to really care about.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.